like to speak about the mind and one is of its main manifestation, which are thoughts. I'll try to go step by step that we may investigate, meditate from different point of views. In the field of our meditation, we have different experiences, hearing sounds, feeling the body, seeing shapes and colors. And I should say, if we are disturbed by some, we know what to do. I ask the fan to be stopped, so that was easy. We just cut down, there was less noise, less disturbance. It was not something very complicated. So to deal with what is given by the five senses, it's rather easy when we are disturbed by something, to a certain extent, of course. We can, it's too noisy, we can stop, or if it's really noisy, we could always try to block our ears, and may help a little bit, or put something. Seeing if it is disturbing, we may turn our head or close our eyes. So it seems that if we have experiences with respect to the five senses, we know how to deal with them, to stop them, or to some extent to make them less strong. If I have some pain in my body, I can move, stand, or lie down. It may help for sometimes, at least, although I'm not completely powerful, but to some extent I exactly know what to do, and I also know when it is beyond what can be done. So in the experience of meditation, it is rather seldom that we complain about noise, about bodily sensations, or about smell or other. We may sometimes, we'd like to shift our complaints, so we may complain about a few of those things, but mainly what it seems that we have a problem with is thought. And thought, it doesn't seem so easy. We can't just turn the fan off. Thought is, we don't exactly know what to do. To stop them, but maybe not to stop them, then I think I should not think. That is another thought, and it seems that we don't exactly know what to do with thinking. Okay, I relax, I don't do anything. So many thoughts, and so I try in a sense not to do anything in order that something will happen. So it is still some way trying to deal with thoughts, but we don't exactly know what to do. It seems that that is an area where we are a bit lost. And if you believe that it is only the 20th century because we are quite confused, well, Gompopa said that so many of his disciples complain about thoughts and they don't know what to do. 11th century. So I think it has a long tradition. It's nothing to do with us. It has rather to do with the nature of thoughts, not with the fact that we are more confused at this time than at previous time. It says many times, Gompopa, that some meditators, many meditators complain about thoughts. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to stop thoughts. He said, because they don't understand how to meditate and they don't understand the nature of thinking. So I would like to inquire a little bit in the nature of thinking, that we may understand. If we don't know what to do with thoughts, it is because we don't know what thoughts are. Not because we are dumb, not because we are not skillful, because we are mistaken with the respect of thoughts. We don't know what they are, therefore we don't know what to do with them. We don't know which tool we can use. We don't find the proper tool. Just give me one tool that I can deal with my mind. I will meditate 20 hours a day and use this tool. But the problem is, give me this tool. In order to find the proper tool, if there is such a thing, we have to know what thoughts are. If we don't know, then it's difficult to understand and deal with this thinking. In our way of knowing the world, we use the five senses, which are quite clear and simple: the seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling. And that's quite a clear type of experiences. You know. So we can see that. You know, you see its color and shape, and we can hear it. And we don't depend on anything other than just our eyes and consciousness, and ears and hearing consciousness, and we have access to the ball and to its sound. It's very clear. So the five senses are giving us access to us, to the world, the respective sphere of object. And it's very clear, there is no mediator. We don't need to mediate the seeing. We don't need a mediator. We just see, and that's fine. There is no mediation in hearing. When there is ear, hearing consciousness and a sound, we hear. So the five senses are giving, revealing to us the object in a clear way. No doubt, we have a proper eyesight. We rather see about the same body, see slightly different from your perspective, yet you understand that. So that the world of senses, and that's why we know what to do, because it's very clear. I don't want to hear the ball, then I can put it somewhere else. I don't beat it. We know what to do. Don't want to see, and I can close my eyes or do whatever. We know exactly what to do. Now, another way for us to know things, or if you wish, the world of senses is giving access to the world directly. But now, in a sense, because of its lack of mediation, it's demanding a lot of condition. A lot of condition. If I want to sell this ball, so we want to speak about it. So if we don't use thoughts, concepts, I need to bring it here, and now you see it, and I speak about the price, and so that is concept. But speak about land. Let's buy some land, some more land to make a huge stupa, for example. Now I'm speaking about that. You understand what I'm speaking about. I did not bring the land there. I don't need to take you all there in front and say, look, that is a land. We speak about that. So the thoughts, images, concept are very powerful because they don't require the presence of the object. They allow us to deal with what is not here. That is a fantastic power of that. So all the thoughts, process, and concept, mental images have a fantastic power because they give some substitution in place of the object, and therefore we are dealing with the substitution of the object, not the object themselves. Again, a fantastic power. Without this power of thoughts, of words, concepts, nothing will ever happen in humankind. Nothing. Even not harvesting. So this fantastic power of thoughts is that it brings, in the field of our experience, a mental image, a concept, which takes the place of the object, and therefore we deal with let's imagine you are teaching me how to make a good meal. So you give me all the concept, the way to do it, and then I go to the kitchen and I make it. So there is a power in the organization of all those thoughts that may then give a concrete result. If we were to learn how to make a proper ball. So in this sense, we use images which are not what they point to. So thoughts, mental images, are always misleading because they appear in a way pretending to be what they are not. And that's their power, and that we are using them. But if we don't recognize that they are not what they pretend to be, they are not what they appear to be like, then we are stuck. Then we are stuck by the power of thought, and we don't know anymore how to deal with thought because we want to deal with objects. And the thought are not the object. So when there is this confusion, which is nearly always for most of us, we are bound by the mistaken power of thoughts, which is to appear in a way and exist in another way. Appearing way, existing way is different. And our way to bring concept, thoughts, not only by bringing images of what is not here, but then we may invent notion which does not exist in the world. Maybe a black ball does exist, but now I say this is bigger than the one we had last year. But bigger does not exist in that. Otherwise anybody coming, having not been to another retreat, will say, oh, this is a bigger ball. So we make notion, bigger or smaller, nicer. And there is no bigger, there is no bigger quality in the actual world. That does not exist. Bigger is only with respect to something else. It's always bigger or smaller according to what we're comparing to. So we make many qualities which do not belong to the world. Bigger, smaller, or whatever, nicer, heavier, lighter, all that, using the same quality, the same capacity of thoughts, mental images, to bring something which does not exist, which is not there, otherwise to bring or to build a world of notion, concept, qualities, bigger, smaller, and whatever we want, heavier. Nothing to do, nothing to do with the world. There is no heavier quality, lighter quality, objectively we can find, Let's go, please bring me something which is bigger by essence. So not only do we bring quality, it's interesting to see in some language like Tibetan, they don't have abstract names. So in order to make those abstract names, they put two opposite names together. So if you were speaking about the good quality or bad quality, they will say, how good bad is that? How good bad is that? Or how heavy light is that? Because they are not those abstract names. So they get from the concrete world, put them together, heavy light. Heavy and light, something that cannot be heavy and light at the same time, therefore you get to some abstraction. Plenty of example that in the Tibetan tradition. So we see that not only thoughts and concepts bring objects which are not there, helping us to deal with that, but also build a world which has no reality, no concrete reality. Comparison. And then we have, as I said, short, long, heavy, light. Then we bring notion like before and after. Is there any beforeness? Yes, the 12th century that was after. It was a century which was after, not after the 11th one, but that was a century which was after, always after. even in the 10th century. That does not exist. Notion of before, after, or even now. Those are just notions like bigger, smaller, that we are imposing to the our vision of the world. And by that, suddenly, as we are creating a more and more organized world, suddenly we are completely surrounded, we are completely trapped into such a beautifully organized world where no area of mystery is left. But this organized world is exactly our jail. I was reading in a magazine that one botanist, he discovered 6,000 new plants in Amazonia. So this fantastic 6,000 new plants. But maybe the big loss, 6,000 plants which are not a mystery anymore. So we are knowing more and more and less mystery there, because we are just being trapped more and more into a world of notion we can grasp through those notions. So we have the world of direct experiences through the senses, and then the world of the mental world, bringing substitute for the object and also organizing that. And the problem is that when we don't realize that is just a mental creation, then we are lost, then we are conditioned, then we are trapped by our own creation. Not recognizing that quality, that nature of the mental process. So it's very clearly stated in Buddhist psychology that the nature of thoughts is that there's a difference between its way of appearing and its way of being, which is not the same for perception. If we see how the children understand the notion of words or concept, it is very interesting, because as they are very outspoken, Piaget used to ask some of the small children, you know, what is heavier, the name lead or the name feather? And of course the children would say, well, the name lead is heavier than the name feather, you know. And we may be on our guard, we are not going to be fooled by that, you know. We know those names, and there's no one heavier than the other one. We are careful about that. Now in our meditation, the thought of a friend arises, and we are happy, and the thought of somebody we don't like arises, and we are not happy. So one is friendlier than the other one. So heavier, we do not get mistaken, but friendlier, that is different. Friendlier we get mistaken. So the power that our thoughts have upon us is only from the simple mistake that the word lead is heavier than the word feather, that the image of a friend is friendlier than an image of an enemy. If we are fascinated in our meditation, positively or negatively, it is always because of this mistake. If we were to read word in a language we don't understand, there would be no fascination. We'll very, very soon close the book and say, let's forget about that. But since we are mistaken, then we are fascinated, again, positively or negatively. So our mind, then we think about this or that in those images. You know, I think about tomorrow, about the next retreat, about the 100 days retreat. It's not here. It's just nothing. 100 days retreat is not longer, is not more meditative than if I think about the Eiffel Tower in Paris. No difference. So we are mistaken with respect to the nature of thoughts. And that's why we don't know how to deal with them. That's why we may experience them as a hindrance to the practice, as cutting ourselves from awareness, as cutting ourselves from a quality of presence that we would like to experience. This understanding, which is not so subtle, we can think about it, this understanding may bring so much freedom in our mind. Doesn't mean to require a lot of silence, just this clear understanding. I'll tell you this very short Chinese story to go a bit more in detail through that. There's a story of this boatman. He has to cross a river in China, so he's guiding his boat. He has certainly a few persons with him guiding his boat, and then suddenly another boat comes and, you know, banging his boat. So he's quite upset and shout at his boat. You know, he said, you know, and the boatman, he said, can you not look? I don't know how insulting Chinese, but you know, he may say, you know, stupid fool, can you not look where you are going? You know, you are going to put a boat in the water. And then the boat is very close, and he sees more clearly. He sees there is no boatman. The boat is empty. The boat is empty, and he's not upset anymore. I'm not upset about an empty boat. So, first he was upset. What did he have in mind? He had in mind the thought of a boatman. Now I see that no boatman in the boat is not upset anymore. Where did this boatman disappear? At what time did he jump in the water? At no time. It was just in his mind. Now, if there were a boatman, before he saw the boatman, there is no difference. There's no difference of the sort of a boatman, either there is a boatman or not. Are you following? It doesn't change anything. The image of the boatman is not more the boatman when there is really one, when there is none. It doesn't change anything. Let's see from a different type of experience. If I would think about my mother and father who died long ago, then I may say, well, I would like to tell this to my father and that, but I have an image of my father, but of course this image of my father has no reference. It's like the empty boat. Father is not here anymore, and his body is not here anymore, and it's just an empty, it's completely empty as a boat is empty. No reference. So it may make me sad, but actually there's no element there, nothing outside there, only an image in my mind which I confuse for a reality which make me sad. But even when my father was alive, if I would sing from America to my father in Switzerland, this image was not more my father than when he's not here anymore. Exactly as empty of my father when he's alive or not. So we may understand how we may bring suffering to us through this confusion. So much confusion from not understanding the nature of thoughts. So thoughts are not concrete, tangible, even though they are not the objective quality that they are pointing out to. They're empty of all that. In our daily life, in our meditation, when sometimes we feel that we are being burdened by thinking, if we are aware of this quality, of the very simple difference between the way a thought arises and the way it exists, this can bring so much lightness in ourselves. So often we believe when we try to get rid of thoughts, there's a mistake in that we want to get rid of what they represent. You know, I have the image of a friend and it's maybe bring sadness or desire, whatever. So now I should get rid of this thought. I don't know how. But if I see that it has no quality of friendliness in that, it loses power. I don't need to try to get rid of that. So the world of memory and thought and all that has no concrete reality, as only the concrete reality that we are giving, and through this power we feel condition. So in our practice, that already one aspect that we can use, and in our daily life, we are bothered by something and we are driving or in the train or whatever, in the plane, and we may always try to be very clear about what is really bothering us. Actually, it may be just empty images or thoughts. So that one not so subtle reflection on the nature of thought, but very powerful, before dreaming about awakening or whatever, it's still important that we realize this quality of thought, that they are not what they represent. But what is the nature of a thought? What it is made of? What stuff is it made of? So what is a thought? I'd like to go into this part of the reflection. And for that, I'll come back to the senses exploration. To the investigation of what is the experience. We're speaking about the mind. What is the experience of hearing, for example, hearing? Now the tendency that we have is to bring concept and images immediately when they are perceptions. So I may say I hear the ball or whatever, but I don't hear an object. If I am very clear to the perception of hearing, there is just the manifestation of consciousness in the aspect of the knowing of a sound. It's just that. Now we can have quality of sound, which may be high pitch, low pitch, or whatever name we are giving. Buddhist psychology is not very precise with quality of sound. Good sound, bad sound, or whatever. Not very precise, but if we believe there are a sound, the hearing of a sound as a color or a shape, which I mistake with that, then I'm lost. I'm not in the intimacy of the experience. We try to be in the very deep intimacy of hearing. Not hearing the ball. That is the source. That is the cause of the sound. I'm not speaking about that. I'm speaking about the intimacy of just hearing. In this intimacy of just hearing, there is no hearer hearing that. There is just a manifestation of consciousness on a specific aspect that we call hearing. And this aspect is a hearing of a sound and is not a seeing of color. If when I hear, I have a black image, that has nothing to do with hearing. So the simplicity or the intimacy of just hearing, if we come to this intimacy, not adding any concept, words, or whatever, in this intimacy, the notion of a hearer and an object known, that will disappear. It is just the quality of presence, and this presence is what is called hearing. Quality of being, hearing. No object, no subject, just hearing. In order to have this intimacy, to develop this intimacy, I must not be confused if I am clinging to the image of the source, then I don't have intimacy. You understand what I say? So anything that we bring more into the experience will hinder the intimacy. So the image, the name, or whatever, that will hinder the intimacy of just that. Just that. Awareness or consciousness manifesting as hearing, which is a very specific and beautiful way of being, is called hearing. In order to do that, I must not be confused with respect to what is a sound. A sound has no form, no shape, no heaviness or lightness. Although we may speak as a metaphor about heaviness, lightness, or color of sound with respect to the experience, then what is specific is high pitch, low pitch, or whatever, just specific to hearing. Same with tasting. If we were to experience tasting, in the intimacy of the experience, tasting has no color, no shape. No color, no shape. It has innocence. It has also no temperature. Temperature will be to the touch feeling. So there is just something very specific and fantastic in the field of experience when presence is manifest as tasting. No taster, nothing being tasted. It's just a way of being tasting. Again, if I am mistaken and I believe tasting has color because I'm eating a strawberry and it should be red, I'm adding something which is not there in the experience, therefore it cut me from the intimacy. So what is taste? Taste is what is sweet or bitter. Buddhist psychology has a bit more words for tasting than for hearing. Certainly we can read the wine guides because they have so many words for tasting, you know. Again, that if we are looking for words, but what is specific to tasting, if we were to explain that with intimacy, we have to know and not to be mistaken, not to look for something red or brownish if it is bread or whatever, but just what is tasting, this quality of sweetness or bitterness that is the experience without naming it. If we are mistaken, we cannot have this intimacy. It's quite simple. But what about thoughts? We understand sounds, that the quality will be high pitch, low pitch. We understand taste, it will be sweet or bitter or whatever. But now what will be the quality of a thought that we can have this intimacy? If I am mistaken, then I cannot have this intimacy. If I am mistaken with respect to the nature of thought, I'll try to be in touch or to be completely open to something which is not the thought, and therefore this intimacy will not be experienced. So what is the quality? I was speaking still on a relative level. What is the quality of a thought that we can be intimate with that and experience it without promoting, sustaining the notion of an object and a subject, of a thinker, thinking, thought? What is this quality? In a sense, a thought, as a sound is high pitch, low pitch, as the taste is sweet or bitter, or the tasting, that experiencing, the thought is a meaning. Nothing but a meaning. It's arising in the field of our experience of a meaning. There's no thought which has no meaning, even when the meaning is stupid. We know it is stupid because it has a meaning. If we imagine an incomplete sentence, well, what is the difference between a table? But it has a meaning. We understand what is being said. He said, Charles, you forget about half of the sentence. We can say that because we understand it. So it is a certain meaning arising, or if you like, consciousness, presence is arising as a meaning, arising doesn't mean. If we stay with this intimacy, with the experience, there is no knower of the meaning. If we believe there should be a knower of the meaning of thoughts, we need so many knower of that knower of the knowing, and it's endless. So there is just in the field of our experience a certain meaning arising. And this meaning is the aspect that the mind is taking at this time, is the aspect that consciousness is taking at this time. If we open to this quality of thought, we will not be drawn to the necessity of keeping a thinker, knowing the thought. You know, I must read my thought like one is reading a book. They don't need that, because the thought has a meaning, and this meaning is clear. The meaning cannot be hidden to itself. So it is also one way that we may start to explore the arising of a thought as a certain meaning that is consciousness, that is awareness, that doesn't need to be known by something outside of the meaning. One way of expressing the process of knowing of the mind, which in many ways is so meaningful, is by speaking about the notion of mimetism. A mimetic. Okay. I read the word in English, but there was no pronunciation when I read it, so I try to explain. A mime, you know what is a mime? Doing something. So the mind is miming. And that, the quality of mind, that the way the mind knows. It's like, you know, doing the same stuff as the object is doing. Mimic. Okay. Mimicking. So that the quality of mind. So it means that the mind has to appear on the aspect of that which is known. I don't want to go in details with the need of something of which it is. You know, I don't want to go to the object, because that will. But that shows the quality. So the quality of mind as just quality of knowing, which does not need the notion of a knower. Just a certain quality of consciousness appearing as a meaning, as a quality of thoughts. And that may also help in the practice to not to sustain the believe that we need a knower of the thought, that we need a reader of the thought, that somebody has to be there to know the thought or the thinker. That we don't need that. And that opens the space for intimacy. Intimacy with the thought process. This intimacy with hearing, with tasting or thinking, it's exactly what the useful world is requiring from us. The world of transformation, the world that we need to deal with in order to build houses, to make food or things like that, it's exactly the quality that it does not require. The quality required in dealing with the world need that we have object and we deal with object. And that is a knowledge of the world. Now we are not inquiring that enough has been done with that, maybe too much. What we inquire into is the nature of the subject, of who we are. Now we have another interest, very different from from the world. We don't need, people are doing that for work, for us, building houses. What we need now is really to know the subject, to know the mind, to know the consciousness. That's what we want to inquire, that's what we want to discover. And in a sense, that does require a reversal of interest, a shift of interest, rather than going always so much fascinated by the outer world, maybe because of anxiety, you know, I need to be sure that I can have food or whatever. We understand the need of that, but now what we want is shifting. We don't care anymore about the source of the sound, about that or whatever. What we want to know is to know ourselves intimately, not ourselves through objective way, you know, concept, I am good, I am bad, I am a rather depressive type, or I am a whatever type. And no, this is a kind of knowledge of the world. No, the intimacy, to know oneself without concept, to know oneself not by thinking about oneself, not by deciding about oneself, to know oneself where the knower and that which is known are one, and not without mediator, without anybody, even if it is my thought telling me who or what I am. So this intimacy requires a shift in interest. For that, it doesn't mean that we need to negate the world, but it means that we are suspending our interest, our involvement, our fascination. If I am now with hearing, as I have described before, just the expense of hearing, I am not so much concerned by the sounds. Not at all. What I am concerned is by intimacy with myself. What I will experience is a deep sense of myself, or who I am, or what I am. I will not be able to write a treaty about the sounds. It's an expense of oneself. So there's a shift, and this shift is essential, of course, to all mystical tradition. Don't want to quote so many mystical tradition where we see that the necessity obviously in any self-inquiry and this shift of that. Again, self-inquiry not as making an object of oneself, you know, looking at oneself as an object, is just making exactly the same mistake, but being more complex. If we were to inquire about the mind in this way of just believing that we are reversing the process but still placing ourselves as an object of observation, you know, so I wonder what is the mind is, and that really as an observer observing the mind, Ramana Maharshi has a very nice example to say that. He said that it is when the thief becomes a policeman, the thief will never be caught. So if we, I think that's an important point. If we believe that we observe now the mind, the thought process, in order to know what is the mind, so we want to get into deep inquiry, so I should really know what the mind is, therefore I will try, I will inquire, analyze, observe the mind to know what the mind is. We know there is only one mind, otherwise we get into other world which I don't know, but let's imagine that in this world there is only one mind. So now there is an observer, the meditator, trying to observe the mind, and the mind is that which knows. The non-mind doesn't know anything. Are you with me? The non-mind doesn't know, only the mind knows. So now if we have to the mind observing thought in order to know, so either the mind is the mind and he's looking at something which is not the mind, therefore we never know the mind. He's looking at a non-mind. I say, no, no. We are looking at the mind. So the looker is a non-mind, and a non-mind doesn't know anything. Therefore, as long as we have this sense that we may look at something in order to know, it's like the thief becoming the policeman. There is no way that we will know. This way of setting two parts in observing, it's only the transposition of what we use in daily world. We are so skillful when we want to observe flowers. We know, and we are so successful in that. And we try to use the same tool with respect to the mind, and that does not work, because we are perpetuating the confusion that we are trying to see through. If we come with the confusion, then that does not help to go and see through the confusion. In one of the sutra, when the Buddha was asked what is the essence of the practice, and the Buddha said, in seeing, just seeing, in hearing, just hearing, in tasting, just tasting, thinking, just thinking. And he said, when, with respect to seeing, you will be neither here nor there nor in between, you will be free. And that also pointing out to the necessity of not placing a meditator observing at some place. It is really the description of intimacy. In one sutra, there's a nice story. The Buddha is with his monks, and he's telling a story of one monk who was seated by the Buddha at one time, and then he had a question. He thought, where does fire, earth, water and air element, where do they cease without remainder? I mean, where does samsara cease? You know, when the four elements, which are all the elements constituting the samsara, where do they cease without remainder? He had this question. And he was an amazing monk who had developed so much concentration, so he had so much power. So he thought that he could go and inquire to some of the gods of the Indian tradition, belonging to Buddhism and Hindu tradition. So first he went to the great king, you know, the four guardians, and asked his question. And they said, well, we don't know, we are very sorry, we don't know. But go to the abode of the 33 gods, you will get the answer then. So monk with his power goes to the abode of the 33 gods and meet all the minor gods. They ask a question. They say, we don't know, but you ask Indra, he will know. The surrounding deity there, they ask him, he asks them, and they say, well, we don't know, but Brahma is about to come, so he will know, he will give you the answer. No worry. So Brahma is coming, and monk is asking, so where does fire, earth, water and air cease without remainder? And Brahma said, I am the best, I am the biggest, I am the root of everything, I understand everything. And the monk said, okay Brahma, you are great, but where does water cease without remainder? And Brahma said, well, I am the best, and I have understood everything. So the monk asked again, he wants an answer, he knows Brahma is so fantastic. So Brahma again says, I'm the best, I'm the biggest, I'm the most fantastic, which is completely right to say. He is at the top of all the gods, so he's right to say that, he's the best, no doubt. And then he takes the monk by the hand and says, please don't ask me this question, you're embarrassing me in front of all my surroundings. He says, I don't know the answer. See, I don't know the answer, but go to the Buddha and ask him. Go to the Buddha and ask him. So monk goes to the Buddha and asks a question, and the Buddha said, don't ask this question this way. Where does fire, earth, water and air cease without remainder? He said, where do they not find any footing? Where do they not find any footing? You see, he's stating differently. If you say, where do they cease without reminder, it means they were existing at one time and they don't exist another time. So you are bringing an element of confusion there, or at least pretending they were existing and now they don't exist anymore. So he said, don't ask, where do they not find any footing? And the Buddha says, in the inborn luminous mind, they don't find any footing. Luminous unborn mind. what does it mean, the luminous unborn mind? When we can experience hearing, tasting, or thinking with the intimacy of not two, the intimacy of one, there is no subject, no object, a world is not being built there, therefore the appearance are seen as not different from the mind, they are not different from consciousness, and the appearance are also experience beyond any notion of it exists, it does not exist, because that belongs to a world that can be stated, a world of duality. Therefore, when there is experience of intimacy, of just hearing, tasting, or thinking, intimacy without duality, the true reality of what is being experienced is not grasped anymore. Not grasped anymore. So appearance and the mind are not separate, and appearance are empty. There's no statement it exists or it does not exist. From one angle here, I want to go to a slightly different way that is stated sometimes. Sometimes we question and we wonder, where does a thought arise from? Where does it abide? Where does it go? So where does it come from and where is it going? This way of questioning, where does a thought arise, for example, we can see that or understand that it does not arise from the world, it doesn't arise from the world that we are seeing, from other people that we are seeing. That may help us to understand that. But in a sense, the way to ask, where does a thought arise, we are bringing with us a confusion. We are bringing, in the questioning, we are bringing a confusion. Where does it arise? It is similar to what I have questioned the other day when Nagarjuna is asking, where does walking start? Because if you question, where is a thought arising from? Now we stay close to the experience. If the thought is there, the arising of it is meaningless. The arising of it is meaningless because arising is in the past and is not there. The past is not there. When a thought is present, its arising is just stepping back in the fictional world of time and duration. Then we start to build a fiction. Where does it arise from? And that wherever it could arise from, that is not existing anymore. Where is it going? In the same way, either the thought is there, so we cannot speak about it's going somewhere, or it's not there anymore. And then we cannot speak also about it's gone somewhere. Nagarjuna states, the existent, because it exists, is not produced. The non-existent, because it does not exist, is not produced. So when we question where does the thought arise from, we may see that in the way for us to look at something, we already start to be in a fiction. And we bring the fiction of time, of separation, and therefore we bring some confusion. It's the same for where does the thought go. Chandrakirti gave an example. He said that, in a sense, when we say that the sprout is coming from the seed, if we question, are they the same or different? Is the source, the sprout and the seed, are they same or different? This is, we cannot ask this question, because we cannot say they are same or different, because they don't exist at the same time. At the time of the seed, there is no sprout. At the time of the sprout, there is no seed. So I can say that Maitreya and Manjushri are different, because they exist at the same time. But something not existing cannot be said different or the same with respect to something existing. So if we come not to the world of explanation, not to the world of fiction, which has its own coherence, and then we'll speak about cause and effect, we know that. We are questioning ultimately. We cannot say that thought is arising, neither that it is disappearing, because that is, will be implying already we step in the fiction of time and we're building something. And it may be interesting for us in our meditation if we believe that thought could come from somewhere, go somewhere, how it means that we may be aware at this time and certainly notice that our meditation is within the framework of time. When we bring the fiction of time, everything can be then, all the fiction can happen. Without time, it's very difficult to have a fiction. So we may be aware of that. So, where is it arising from? When you see that we bring in the notion of time, where is it going to? It also brings the notion of time. And where does it abide? That come to what we have been inquiring before, the intimacy of not splitting an observer and a mind being observed. This way, this belief that we have that something to be known imply a knower and something be known. This strong belief is true, completely true, for any object which is not a knowing or a knower. Any object need to be known, a knower, no doubt. But the knower, here the mind, doesn't need a knower of the knower, because its nature is knowing. Dharmakirti said that the self-knowing of the mind is its luminosity. So no need to split the mind into one aspect knowing the other. Its nature is knowing, and it is impossible that it doesn't know itself, because its nature is knowing. What would hide itself from itself? Where could the shadow come from? Shadow doesn't come from the light. So I think Dharmakirti said that very clearly, self-cognition is the luminosity of consciousness itself. So one doesn't need to borrow a light. You take a candle to see that the candle is lighted. One doesn't need a light to see a light. The nature of consciousness itself is luminosity, the knowing power. Now when that is experienced with intimacy, without confusion, without duality, nothing can be stated. All the statements that we are used to, it exists, it does not exist, are statements which are meaningful in a world of objects, in a world when we are stating that this world exists in this way or that way. It exists, it does not exist, is meaningful in the world of fiction. In the experience of the intimacy of the clear luminosity of mind, that has no meaning. It exists, it does not exist. Therefore, awareness there is experience neither as existing nor non-existing. And if we were to believe, then it's just nothing to say it's just nothing is again to step in the world of fiction where we want to say it is something or nothing. We cannot say anything. Neither it is something or nothing. Any statement will be a mistake, will be misleading. So we cannot say anything about it. Neither can we say it is located somewhere. It's not located. We cannot say it is here or there. Here or there will only be meaningful in a world where there are at least two. In a world where there is one, so to speak, maybe even that is too much to say, but in a world where there are not two, here or there is meaningless. And the experience, of course, is not that I experience awareness here or there. It is interesting to see in Greek philosophy, I think Aristotle said that if something exists, it must exist somewhere. And obviously speaking, we understand about the world, objective world, which is created, then if we want to speak about it, it has to exist somewhere. But in the intimacy of awareness, even that notion doesn't hold. It cannot be, it is somewhere. So if we thought, or if we think in our meditation that thoughts are disturbing, it is because we are not experiencing them with intimacy. When they are nothing different from the mind, and their empty nature is also clear. And if we experience them as something disturbing, it means that we are giving them reality. They can only be disturbed if they are objectively objectified. If they are only an aspect of the mind, they don't hide anything. There is not a problem. And it is important in our practice to experience thinking or thought in this way, that in this intimacy, that the belief in the need or in the wish there will be no thought will be completely dried out. That we don't even pray for no thoughts. It's meaningless. But we can experience the freedom within even the thinking process. In the text about meditation, often it says not to, in the practice of meditation, not to try to push away something or to bring something. It is pong long mepa, or re do mepa, no hope, no fear. No. So we understand, okay, if I'm practicing, I should not try to push this away, not try to bring that. I understand the technical aspect of that, no hope, no fear. I understand I should not wish for some experience or fear some other experience. But in a sense, in the oneness of the experience, this is meaningless, because there is nothing else that one could bring in, and there is nowhere else that we could send something out. There is nothing that we may wish for, because there is no time, nothing that we will also fear. So this pong long mepa, nothing to push away or to bring forth, no hope, no fear, is also a technical instruction, but also the dimension of the experience. That when there is intimacy, these notions are meaningless. Even if we were to say, what could I try to get rid of? That is completely absurd. What could I try to bring in is also absurd. What to feel is absurd. What is quality, dimension of the experience? So this inquiring into thinking may show us different ways and at different times that we can use. When the mind is quieter and more receptive, then at this time we may just stay with the intimacy to realize the knowing or quality of the mind, the non-dual aspect, But at time when we are concerned or more busy, then we may really reflect on what is the nature of thought, what is this thought about somebody or someone or something disturbing me. This power that I'm giving. If we see clearly at what time what we use, I think that may bring some freedom in our practice. So I try to cover some aspect of this inquiring into the nature of soul that we may have maybe some clue. You have heard many times also from more absolute way, but here a bit step by step to